Hello again, everyone. This is Julia McCutcheon, founder and creative director of the International Association of Conscious and Creative Writers at IACCW.com, where writers discover their authentic voice on the page and in the world. And welcome to our free monthly teleseminar interview for IACCW members. These events are designed to inspire and inform you about everything you need to know to succeed as a conscious and creative writer in the contemporary marketplace. So thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and a very warm welcome to those of you who are listening to the audio recording. We're here today to talk about the way of story, and I'll be introducing my special guest speaker, Catherine Ann Jones, in just a moment. So first of all, I'll just explain how these calls are organised for those of you who have recently joined the IACCW. Now, our interview is scheduled to last for about 60 minutes, and for those of you on the live call, we will open up for questions towards the end, so do make sure that you write down any points you'd like to ask about while we're speaking. And the audio recordings are posted to the members-only area at IACCW.com, and once you've logged in there, you'll find them on the past events page. And each month, we take the topic of our teleseminar interview as the theme of the month in our writers community, which is based in the IACCW Facebook group. And just to explain that this idea is to support you to take action and to make time for regular progress with your writing and for all of the activities relating to your authorship. So we make a few suggestions for how you can engage with each of our themes, and of course we also encourage you to come up with your own ideas as well. And if you aren't already a member of this group, which is open both to members and non-members of the IACCW, I do recommend that you join us. In that group you can share your news and blog posts and anything related to writing and what you're doing as an author. And it really is a good opportunity for you to connect with other like-minded writers. And you will find the group by logging into Facebook and typing International Association of Conscious and Creative Writers into the search box and just simply clicking the link to the group which pops up. Okay, so let's move on to today's interview then with our special guest speaker, Catherine Ann Jones. Now, I first came across Catherine's work when she ran a seminar in London called The Way of Story, and the title completely resonated with me. It really caught my attention, and I really loved that title, The Way of Story. And the more I looked into the fabulous teaching that Catherine does, the more inspired I felt. And that led to me inviting her to speak to you all here at the IACCW, and I'm delighted that she accepted that invitation. Let me share with you a little bit more information about her from her official bio. And Catherine Ann Jones is an award-winning playwright and Hollywood screenwriter of such films as The Christmas Wife, Unlikely Angel, Angel Passing, which premiered at Sundance, winning 15 awards in the US and internationally. She was also a writer for the popular TV series Touched by an Angel. A Fulbright scholar to India studying shamanism, graduate of Pacifica Graduate Institute, and author of The Way of Story, she teaches worldwide. Online courses are available at dailyom.com, and for writing consultant services and workshop schedules, you can visit wayofstory.com. So I will repeat those websites at the end and do encourage you to find out more about Catherine's work from both of those websites. So Catherine, a very warm welcome to you and thank you so much for joining us here on the call today.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here. You know, writing's a solitary act, so it's wonderful to share with other writers.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. So let's start then with you telling us your story of how you got into writing in the first place and how that turned into the incredibly successful career that we just heard a little bit about.
Well, I think usually most of us are born with what we do later. It may be latent at first, but it's kind of there from the get-go. I started writing at 7. I wrote very bad poetry for a number of years and won a lot of contests and did a lot of journaling.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got sidetracked into acting. My first career was acting in New York City, Broadway, off-Broadway. And I grew tired of the new plays I was doing, the way women were depicted, the female roles. So I sat down one day, and I had just done a play, a comedy about Virginia Woolf, the English writer.
Yes.
And I got very involved with researching her because, of course, when you portray a character who really lived, you do a lot of research. So I read everything I could about her and by her. And long after the play closed, 2 months later, I was still reading about Virginia Woolf. And I was always fascinated by this razor's edge between genius of creativity and madness, Nijinsky, Van Gogh, and Virginia Woolf, to name a few. So at the time, there was no play about her life, so I wrote a bioplay, and that was my first long play because I wanted to depict three-dimensional female characters. That was my motivating action. And the play won a National Endowment of the Arts Award. That's our biggest award in America. And that launched my career as a playwright. And then I did that for a while. I had 10 plays produced in and out of New York. And one was optioned by MGM in Hollywood, and I was invited to come to California and write movies. So that I went west from New York. I went to Los Angeles and started writing for the films. But I've always had a parallel career teaching writing.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, the New School University, which has a habit of inviting professionals to teach rather than academics. And they asked me to teach a course in playwriting. So when they first asked me, I said, writing cannot be taught. And the chairman was very clever. He said, we'll teach it from that perspective. And I was so impressed by his, you know, with what he told, what he said, by his answer, that I was hooked. So I taught 8 years playwriting, and I use improvisation to teach playwriting, because if you write dramatic writing, like for films and plays, it's not meant to stay on the page. It has to walk and breathe. Mm-hmm. So I found using improvs was a great way to get that across to non-actors. And even to this day, I always encourage my writing clients and students to take an improv class or acting class. And then for 20 years, I taught graduate playwriting, and then at USC in LA, I taught another 8 years screenwriting. And I realized after 20 years something was missing, because for 20 years I taught the craft of writing. And to me, craft, though it's of course enormously important, it's fundamental structure and dialogue and character development, so on, it's only half the story. No pun intended. That equally important, I believe, are what I call the invisibles. That could be intuitive writing, channeling, writing from the whole of yourself, your senses. I left teaching university, and I first launched the first wave of story at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California. And to try and design exercises not only to teach craft, but to integrate with craft the invisibles. I did an interview years ago in the New York Times, and this is one sentence I said, which I think sums it up. So I'm quoting now from the Times. We've become lopsided, living only in our heads. Writing, in order to serve the soul, must integrate outer craft with the inner world of intuition and feeling. So my aim is with the workshops and in the Way of Storybook is to integrate both sides of the brain. In other words, to bring the whole of yourself to the writing table, not just the less logical brain. So that's kind of the nucleus of what I try and do. And people come out of the workshops. I do 1-day, 2-day, and 5-day workshops, and they say things like, you changed my life, or this course changed my life. And of course, I didn't do anything. I'm just a catalyst. But what happened is they go to deeper places than they usually go. For instance, we use visualizations and do something I call the soul dialogues, where we dialogue with deeper parts of ourselves. And if you can bring those depths into your writing, then you have something very powerful, I think.
Superb. I mean, I love the way that you've been describing that, and it's so resonant with my own approach to writing and the whole theme and the energy of the IACCW, in fact, that combination of the right and the left brain, the craft with the intuition, and all that you've described is exactly really how we like to approach it here too, which is wonderful. I'd love to just pick up on a couple of points that you made, actually, if I may. The fascination that you had in the early days about that razor's edge that you described between genius and madness, I think that's something that many of us actually have a fascination with, and obviously that triggered a play and all sorts of other things for you. I was just wondering if you had any more to say about that in connection to the writing process that people can perhaps take away to explore a little bit with their own writing in that razor's edge space.
Well, of course, the Virginia Woolf play, which later was called On the Edge, is about a woman's struggle with madness in a world gone mad, the world of Hitler and World War II. But I guess my own point of view is that, you know, extraordinary things come through us when we're open channels for art, rather like the Plato oversoul idea, that if we touch on that, things come through us that are much more than just our little selves. Yeah. And I remember reading years ago Nijinsky's diary or journal. And, of course, he had genius and extraordinary things flowed through him and his body. And he made the mistake of claiming what came through. In other words, he thought he was Jesus Christ because he had these spiritual sensations of the energy. And I think when our ego gets involved, that's where the madness comes. That's my own kind of perspective on this.
Yeah.
So if you just let it pour through you and know that it's not you or it's not yours, it's something greater, then all kinds of things may happen, but you don't have to go crazy.
Yeah, you know? Lovely.
I'm sure other writers who are listening have had that delicious experience of writing something and then picking it up and reading it as though for the first time.
Yes.
And you think, where did this come from? Yes. Did I write this? And that's what I'm talking about. That's when writing's at its best, where you're a portal for something much larger than yourself. But you don't say, this is mine. You, in other words, it has a humbling effect, and you feel only gratitude that you were able to be the portal for it.
Yeah, beautifully put. Yeah, thank you. That's a lovely way of describing it, and I couldn't agree more, really. I think that what you said about when the ego getting involved, that's when the madness comes. And I think that's often when writers go off track as well. When the ego gets involved.
And all artists, not only writers. But
indeed.
Painters,
so on. Yeah, so I think many writers need to learn really just to get out of their own way and to allow that that portal image is a good one for something larger than yourself to come through, which is lovely. And just one other point I'd like to pick up on before we dive into more deeply into our topic, but you also mentioned that you always encourage your students to take some kind of improvisation or acting class. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, because I think that many writers might be interested to hear how they might benefit from that kind of approach.
Well, even when I teach the Way of Story workshops, I use improv. So I'll give an example, and I think I write about this in the book. I had a very bright woman who was writing a memoir, and she was intellectually quite brilliant. But she did the workshop, the series 5 and 10, 15-minute writing exercises, and then we have feedback. And she wrote a dialogue, and it was very dry. It was just not very interesting. It was very one level and very dry. It had no juice.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her to put her paper and pen down and to trust me and get on her feet, and I took another person from the group, and we did an improv. And I did it where physically she had to push to an extreme. I have them stand with outstretched hands pushing on each other so they feel the adrenaline starts to go. And of course, what she ended up saying in the improv was light years away from what she had written. Everyone applauded at the end, and she got it. She saw that what came out of her organically was much more powerful than what her left brain had written. Now, I could lecture for 2 hours about that, and it wouldn't get across. But by getting them on their feet and having them experience what I'm trying to convey, then it'll stay with them.
Yeah, lovely. What a great example that is. And it also picks up on another point that I feel very passionate about too, which is getting the body moving, actually, getting up and walking or doing some yoga and not being so static when you're writing, because it's very easy for writers to get quite stuck in a static place where they're sitting typing at a keyboard or however people like to write. And I think getting the body moving is...
I'll give you an example of just that. I was writing a movie for Dolly Parton. She's an American superstar.
Yeah.
She's writing a movie for Universal Studios. And it was a fictional story that had come to me in a dream, by the way. I get a lot of my stories at night when I sleep. And I was stuck. I had a deadline for the studio, and I was stuck in Act Two. I knew what was going to happen, but I didn't know how I was going to make it happen.
Mm.
So this is something I often do. I just stopped writing. I left my office. And I went to the club and started swimming laps.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the story and the movie totally out of my conscious mind. I didn't think about it. I just walked away. And long about the 13th lap, the solution came.
Yes.
My conscious mind had let go of it, but my unconscious took it over and found the solution.
Yeah, perfect.
So what I try and do in the workshops is, you know, there's so much to our mind that we don't use. And we have all kinds of what I call invisible allies, guides, or whatever, if we just let go of the conscious ego mind and let it come. So the answer came, and I made my deadline.
Oh, good for you. That's lovely. Okay, so
That movie was called Angel Passing.
Oh,
by the way, it's on DVD now, yeah.
Fantastic. So in terms of the Way of Story then, how would you actually summarize what the Way of Story actually is? Because you've mentioned that your approach is very much a combination of craft and intuition, which I love. How would you describe what Way of Story is?
Well, this is a sentence or two on my book jacket, so I'll just read that. The Way of Story, the subtitle of the book and workshop, is The Craft and Soul of Writing. The Way of Story is an integrative approach to writing all forms of narrative, illustrated. Craft alone is not enough. It's the integration of solid storytelling technique and experiential inner discovery that sets this book apart. So hopefully that will give some idea. And I just want to mention, the book and workshop is for all forms of narrative writing, not just play and screenplay.
Because
I began to notice, though I taught playwriting and screenwriting for 20 years, that what I was teaching there were the principles of story, and they were applicable to all forms of narrative fiction and nonfiction, whether it was a mystery or a novel or a memoir or biography. And because for better or worse, media's had a tremendous influence on how everything's written today. Gone are the days when a reader will buy a novel and be content to wait 50 pages before the inciting incident or the first beat of the story or before something happens. Of course, that would rule out such writers as Proust, Dostoevsky, and Tolstoy.
Yes.
But I think the reality today is that in the first 5 or 10 pages, you have to bring in the dramatic action.
Yeah.
So that's why the workshops were all forms of narrative writing.
And would you say that, I mean, obviously all types of writing and writers can benefit from understanding your approach, the way of story. What tips and suggestions would you have specifically for nonfiction writers to apply to their nonfiction writing, what you're describing here?
Well, again, I usually teach by example, so I'm going to cite a couple of examples. One interesting development, even on the dissertation level of people getting their PhDs in university, they used to be encouraged to write the dissertation from a very objective point of view. That shifted now. Now they want a subjective point of view. So they want the writer of the dissertation, regardless of what the material is, to bring in their own point of view. So even at the level of academia, that has shifted. Sometimes I have clients who are psychologists or psychiatrists, and they'll be writing a nonfiction book about psychology. But, of course, there'll be a lot of case studies. And they find that the best way to get their thesis or their ideas across is by citing case studies or specific examples. Good writing is all about specifics, not generalities. So in that way, they have to learn how to construct narrative. You know, it's the same thing that caveman did when he came back and sat around the fire and talked about the hunting trip. You know, it's story. It's all about story and how to, the most powerful way to get a story across.
Yeah,
so that applies to all forms of fiction and nonfiction.
Fantastic. So you talk about the 7 steps to story structure. Can you tell us what those 7 steps are and how writers can understand and use those 7 steps to the best advantage?
Well, that's a more academic part of the writing. But my aim with the craft part that I teach in the workshops and in the book is to give tools you can use for your lifetime as a writer.
Yeah.
So I evolve what I call the 7 steps to story structure. And before I convey those, I have a whole chapter about that in the book, of course. But I'll just mention that it can be useful. One thing I wanted to say in the beginning, and I neglected to, is that I don't believe there's one way to write anything any more than there's one way to live your life. So some people like to just sit down, face a blank page, have no idea where they're going, and just go for it. And then they have more work to do when it comes to rewriting, but that may be their process. So I think it's important to discover and honor your own process.
Yeah.
But the 7 steps to story structure can be useful. Some people like to begin with this before they write a first draft. Others, like I earlier mentioned, might like to just freely write a first draft and then as a tool for rewriting use the 7 steps. So it doesn't really matter as long as you get where you're going, you know, what order you do. So and this applies again to all forms of narrative. Step number one, problem. Every story must have a problem, and the problem's connected to the need of your main character. For instance, he'll be very aware of the problem, but he won't be conscious. He won't know how to solve it. And he may be totally unconscious of his need, what his need is. The development of your story will make him conscious by the end. Something is missing in the main character or protagonist, which is usually based on a character flaw. Step number two is desire. Desire is always a particular or specific goal. And it's important to distinguish between need and desire. They're related, but they're not the same thing. For example, say you're in Africa and there's a hungry lion. So his need is hunger. Then he sees a gazelle running across the veld, and the gazelle is at the back of the herd and slower than the others. So his gaze focuses on that one gazelle. That's his specific desire. So to fulfill his need, he must obtain his desire. So, for instance, if you know what your character desires, you know who he is. It's a very powerful tool in creating character. Step number three is opponent, competing for the same or opposite goal or same territory. And there may be both external and internal opponents.
Okay.
Step number four, the plan. This is a set of guidelines the hero or heroine uses to overcome the opponent and reach his goal, obtaining his specific desire. Things inevitably go wrong, and the hero has to regroup, finding a new plan, new solutions. And there'll be many milestones before the final battle. Step number five is the final battle. And the conflicts get more and more intense. The final battle is the last conflict. And again, this is true of comedy as well as drama. Step number six, self-revelation. The lies are stripped away. The hero undergoes a profound change where he learns something fundamental about who he is and his place in the world. The best stories also have a moral revelation. That is, not just who he or she is, but how they should act with others. And the final step, number seven, a new life begins. The hero is either at a higher or lower level than at the beginning of the story. This may be either positive or negative. A test question might be, how has my main character changed in some fundamental way? So those are basically the seven steps of story structure.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking us through these. And obviously, anyone who'd like to follow up the detail on that can buy and read your book and go into that chapter in more detail. But certainly to have that overview, I think, is helpful for everybody listening to take away and just think about in relation to their own writing. So thank you very much for that.
You're welcome. One thing, Julia, I'd love to share, if I may.
Yes, please.
If the listeners take one little kernel from me today, this may be it. It's just one sentence, but I'll say it twice.
Okay.
What's important in a story is not what happens. What's important in a story is not what happens, i.e. the plot. What's important in a story is how what happens changes your main character and changes his view of himself, others, and the world around him.
Yeah.
So what's important in a story is not what happens. What's important is how what happens affects your main character, for better or worse, and changes him in some fundamental way. Anyway, I just wanted to.
No, that's very powerful.
How many times have we read a book or seen a movie, and all the plot intricacies, this happens and that, and you sit there totally unmoved, and then you pick up F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story, Bernice Bobs Her Hair, about a young girl in the 1920s who cuts her hair off, and you're crying. So it's not what outwardly happens. It's the, it's all about character.
Indeed. And I was just going to say, you've given us some tips already about creating memorable characters, and obviously effective dialogue is very important. I mean, what would you say in terms of offering some tips to writers with regard to effective dialogue?
Well, again, I have a whole chapter on that in the book, but a couple of points. Dialogue is not conversation. A lot of people confuse the two. My graduate students would bring in exercises on dialogue, and when I would critique it, they would be surprised, and they'd say, but that's exactly what they said. I took that from real life. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to remind them that dialogue is not conversation. Art is not a photograph. It's a painting.
Mm-hmm.
So and what's missing usually when people write like that, just externally, so to speak, is they're not putting in their point of view. What makes a painting or a work of writing powerful is the perspective of the artist or the writer. And your perspective, of course, is made up of how you feel, what your values are, what you feel strongly about. So that has to be there. So the subjective aspect is probably, in a way, the most important part of any work of art.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you. I think that I'm sure that we could have a whole hour's conversation just about that, but I think that that's such a...
One other point I was going to make about dialogue. Because dialogue, of course, is used not only in plays today. Sometimes there are whole novels that are 90% dialogue today. It's again, the influence of media on how everything's written. I think the most important part about dialogue is what is not said, but implied. I think if you keep that in mind, you'll know what to cut when you start rewriting.
Yeah, great tip. I love that. I think that... There's a quote which it just reminded me of, and I'm not sure if I can remember the exact words, but it's something about that perfection is achieved not when there is something more to add, but when there is something more to take away. When there's nothing more to take away.
I have a great example of that from Japan, if I may share that.
Please do.
It's interesting, because everything we say, of course, the associations, it reminds me of something else.
Yeah.
In Japan, there's a discipline of aesthetics called, I think it's wabi-sabi, something like that.
Yes.
And a master potter, for instance, will make this great pot, work of art, and it'll be totally perfect. But the pot is not completed until he does one last thing. And that last thing is to consciously create a flaw. In other words, the perfection is in the flaw.
Yes.
And I use this in my chapter on character. No one knew this better than your countryman, William Shakespeare.
Yes.
I mean, where would Macbeth be without the fatal flaw of ambition?
Mm-hmm.
Where would Othello be without jealousy? Where would Hamlet be without his inability to act, his indecisiveness? So the fatal flaw in your character is the tragic flaw. It need not be fatal, but the tragic flaw is very... So I thought it was a wonderful parallel to find this about Japanese art.
Yeah, lovely, fantastic, thank you.
I've actually, as a writing consultant, been given novels. I was once given a 400-page novel to work on, and the main characters were perfect people.
Mm.
It's the most boring thing I've ever read in my life.
Yes, I can imagine. Okay, so we've spoken about the balancing of the craft and the intuitive skills. And the importance of doing so, we've agreed that that's really the best way forward. What specific tips do do you have to offer writers with regard to actually achieving that? I mean, how do writers do that in terms of getting that balance right between the craft and the intuitive skills?
Well, in the workshop, I don't know if it's something I can say. I could suggest that by doing the exercises in the book or in the workshops, it sort of happens automatically.
Okay.
See, I like to teach in an organic and experiential way. It's not just like mathematics, this is the axiom kind of thing.
Sure. Well, maybe there's an exercise that you could describe for us that
that's what I was about to do. I was teaching a workshop, a five-day workshop at Esalen a few years ago, and I actually described this in the last chapter. But there was an elderly man who had been a soldier in World War II, and he was he'd been working on a memoir for many years and wasn't able to really do it. He was having problems with it, so he came to the class. And in World War II, he was with a group of American soldiers who freed a concentration camp, Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an experience he never forgot, and he wanted to write a memoir about that. So he read us something of what he wrote, and again, it was very dry. There was no juice.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, would you do an improv? And he was very open and game. So I sat him in a chair in the middle of the room, and we had about 29 people in the class, and I picked 7 of them and had them lie on the floor. And I had asked, and meanwhile, he was sitting in the chair with his eyes closed. Then I led him through a visualization and said, when you open your eyes, you're not remembering that day. You're actually experiencing that day. And he opened his eyes, and he saw these bodies lying on the floor. And I said, what's the first thing you notice, and so on. Anyway, through this reenactment, a memory came up that he had suppressed for decades, that when he walked among the bodies, there was one man still alive, and he took water to this man.
Wow.
It was so powerful, and he came up afterwards at the break. I mean, the whole class was crying. It was very powerful. And the man came up to me and said, this has changed my life. He said, I realized why I wasn't able to write this before. I had to feel it.
Mm.
And I think that's the one thing I hear a lot in the workshops. And you have to feel it first. If you can feel it strongly, that will come across the page or from the screen. Mm. You know, we go to movies in order to feel, and often we read books for the same reason. So if you know that, you can be in touch and know it's, if you can feel it first, you have more chance of creating that for your reader or audience.
Lovely,
so
yeah.
Again, that's improv, but there are a lot of, it's all about subjective feeling. I don't mean, in fact, of just becoming indulgent, because then you balance it with craft, of course.
Mm.
But it's... personal myth is another exercise that's very popular. I created. I have a graduate degree in Jungian psychology, too, so a lot of the work is very psychological. I put in the writing courses. Personal myth, briefly, it has two parts. I ask them first, and the trick of these exercises is don't think too long about it. Go with what pops into your mind first, even if it doesn't surprises you or doesn't seem to make sense. In other words, let your unconscious choose. So part one of personal myth is, I say, remember when you were young, choose a fairy tale or a book you read that you really identified with. You know, something that grabbed you. It could be Snow White or Treasure Island. It could be a TV show, anything. And just briefly, for 5 minutes, write down the broad strokes of the story. Once upon a time, Cinderella lived with her stepmother and 2 stepsisters, and so on and so on. Just a simple outline of the story. That's part one. Then part two is, I want you now to write this story in the first person, only you are Cinderella or Snow White or Hansel and Gretel or whatever, and choose some part of your own life. It can be real or imagined, but write it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very powerful exercise. And it also tells you what themes you should be writing about if you do this exercise honestly.
Fantastic.
Because you'll know what you feel strongly enough, and that's what you should be writing about.
Mm.
So a lot of the people don't know what story they want to write at the beginning of the workshop, but just in doing the exercises, their story finds them.
Lovely, yeah.
And those that already know what story they want to write, I ask them to skew the exercises to the project.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of works both ways.
Lovely.
I do something called soul dialogues, which I can't really do in an interview, but I do a visualization where I take them to a deeper level in their psyche and then have them write a dialogue to see their soul as a metaphor and then address engage in a dialogue with a deeper part of themselves.
Lovely, yeah.
So that's very revealing, too.
I think
you write in order to know yourself, you know, and these are just tools to go a little deeper in that process, maybe.
Yeah, superb. Fantastic.
And the interesting thing is the more subjective the writer is, the more he really goes down and reveals not only his ideals, but his dark side, his shadow side. The amazing thing is by being that specific, you reach the universal.
Yeah.
You can't write universals. As Graham Greene once wrote, you cannot love humanity. You can only love people. You need the specifics. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example, if I may, from my earlier in my career. I was writing plays, and I had written plays about Catherine Mansfield, Virginia Woolf, Calamity Jane. And inevitably, I had to sit down and write what I call the inevitable dysfunctional family play. And I sat down and wrote about three generations of women in Texas. That's where I grew up. And it was so personal and so subjective, I was sure that no one would get it. It was so Texas. It was so my story. And I thought, this is something just like an exorcism. I have to write and then put it in a drawer just to get it out of my system so I can move on. That was what my belief was. And it was the hardest thing I've ever written. I'd be in the middle of writing a scene, a mother-daughter scene, and I'd end up riding a bike for an hour and crying and crying. Then I would come back and finish the scene. So you see, apropos of what we said earlier, the feeling was there, very much there.
Yeah.
So I finished the play. I won more awards with that play than any of my other plays. And it totally surprised me. But I learned an important lesson then, in that the universal lies in the specific and not the other way around.
Okay.
You got that? The universal lies in the specific. When the play was done, people would come up afterwards and say, I'm from Canada. That's my mother exactly. How could you know? I'm from Kansas. That's my sister. That's my family. How could you know that?
Yes.
You see, I was more surprised than anyone. I had just told of course, I had exaggerated my story and dramatically taken it to an extreme. It wasn't literally. But the starting point was true.
The
more you give, the more you'll reach others. The more you give from your own, of yourself.
Very powerful teachings here, Catherine, which is really delightful. What I'm going to do is just suggest that we pause for a moment and just open up the line to see if we have any questions from the people who are on the live call, because I'd love to give people the opportunity to speak to you directly. So let me invite those of you who are on the live call, if you want to ask a question or share a comment with Catherine, all you need to do is to press *0 on your telephone keypad and then say your name so that we can make sure that we can hear you, and then you can ask your question. So don't be shy, because this is a fantastic opportunity to speak to Catherine, and I invite you to do so right now. So who'd like to ask a question? Well, as I said to you earlier, Catherine, we do have a lot of shy participants in our regular interviews. Just another minute or two to invite you to press star zero on your telephone keypad to ask a question.
Hello, it's Jo here.
Oh, hello, Jo. Well done. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hello, Catherine. Could you tell a bit more about the soul dialogue? What do you see as the soul? How would you define it?
Well, it's not so much, for the purposes of the exercise, I would define it as the deepest part of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I would ask the people to, after the visualization, which is at the end of chapter one, to just visualize a metaphor that would represent the deepest part of yourself. It could be an animal, a bird, a flower, a jewel, or some precious object. And visualize that and feel that. And then just engage in a dialogue with soul. Ask soul one simple question. What do you want? And write that on the top of the page. What do you want? And then listen from that deeper place for a response, and write down what soul tells you. That's one soul dialogue we do. So it would be your psyche, or the deepest part of yourself. I hope that answers that.
Yes, that clarifies it quite a bit. Thank you.
Great. Good question, Jo. Thank you very much for that. Anybody else like to ask a question of Catherine? So, Jo, if you just press star zero on your telephone keypad just to mute your line again, that would be perfect. Thank you very much. Anyone else? Questions? Okay, well, I'm going to keep...
Hello.
Hello, who's that?
Hello, this is Daphne here.
Oh, hello, Daphne.
I haven't as such got a specific question, but I just want to say... what a wonderful interview this has been, and how the examples that Catherine has given have been so very vivid and extremely useful. They've really resonated with me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daphne. It's very good to have something come back like that.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Super. Thank you so much, Daphne, for that contribution. Wholeheartedly agree, and I'm sure that many others listening also agree, and just well done to you, Daphne, for speaking up. So thank you.
Thanks.
Good.
Julia, I don't know if this is the right time, but I wanted just to share too, if they go to my website, there are links to the online courses.
Okay, yes, that's absolutely fine. Why don't you do that now?
Okay, on wayofstory.com on the homepage, it mentions there's two online courses. There are links there, and they're done by dailyom.com, but you can just go to my homepage and it'll take you there. One of them is a 16-week wayofstory.com, and the other is a heal yourself with writing, which I use my psychology training more. And it's for writers and non-writers about healing grief and trauma through writing. So those are there for people anywhere to do.
Lovely. Well, thank you. And I certainly do recommend that that you all check those courses out. I'm sure they're really excellent courses to follow. And Catherine, while we're on this subject of people following up with you after this interview, as I'm sure many will want to, not just buying your book, but I know that you have a very busy teaching schedule and you teach all around the world, and information about that is obviously on your website, but do you have anything coming up that you'd like to mention?
Yes, it's wayofstory.com. You can go for workshops. It's all there. I also have a blog, waynews.com. that's on the homepage. And my workshop schedule is there, and I do consultations for people who live all over. And you just go wayofstory.com consultation. So all that's up there. And I'm going to be teaching a week in Tuscany, June 11th to 18th, which sounds very exciting. It's a restored monastery in the middle of a Chianti vineyard. So I think inspiration's assured whether you write or not there. But the flyer is also on the home page. But Julia, what I'd love to do if we have at the very end, I have the very short prologue, which is a few sentences from Way of Story. I'd love to end with that, if I may.
Absolutely.
Whenever that's appropriate.
Well, yes. I mean, how long do you think we need for that? Because we've got about 5 or 6 minutes before we end.
Oh, I would say 1 minute.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, then. In which case, I'm just going to ask Daphne to put your line back on mute. Could you just press *0 for me to put the line back on mute, which would be perfect if you could do that. In which case, I think we've probably got time for maybe another question or two from me. And we've covered such a lot of ground already and a wealth of material that you've shared with us. You know, as Daphne said rightly, the examples that you've given have been incredibly vivid to illustrate your points. And one point that you made earlier and you mentioned were what you call the invisibles. And I would love to just invite you just to say a little bit more about how writers can invite the invisibles to free the story up from within them. What would you say about that?
Oh, goodness. We need an hour just for that one. Well, keep a journal by your bed. If you're interested in something, think about it as you go into sleep. And I get a lot of ideas from dreams, and waking dreams as well as sleeping dreams. There's that very special time when you just awake, where you're not awake and you're not asleep, that in-between time. That's a wonderful portal where great ideas can come. That's one thing. I think writers are always writing, whether they're putting it down on paper or not. It's that's why I have a chapter here called The Way of Story as a Life Path.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's not just about resume or career or publication, but it's a way of looking at the world. So that's the invisibles are spiritual, they're psychic. I got one of my best ideas when I was on a honeymoon in Ireland, and I saw something in the waking state, and I found out years later when I sat down to write it that what I saw actually happened historically.
Mm.
In detail, it happened in the 9th century. So, you know, it's a vast world of invisibles out there if we tap into it.
Yes.
It's much more than, there are more things on heaven and earth that you are dreamt of, Horatio.
Most definitely. And I'm sure you find this yourself and with your students, that the more that you open yourself to these unseen energies, ideas, creative sources, however you want to describe it really, the more accessible they are. And it's a cumulative process, I think.
I think it's important to realize, because writing's a very solitary, lonely act, but that when you open yourself to the invisibles, the allies come, the world opens, and we are not alone.
Yeah, lovely. No, that's beautiful. Thank you. And so I'd like to just ask one final question before you read your piece out, and then I think that will pretty much take us to time. And it's going to shift us into a slightly different arena, because one of the points that you make is with regard to how to write a story outline as a successful marketing tool. And we've talked a lot about, the intuition and the craft and the invisible side of writing. And then when writers want to take their work out into the world, then we need to shift into a slightly different gear, don't we? And I wonder, because you've been so very successful at so many different levels with writing, I wonder if you could share some of your wisdom and experience with us on the whole point about writing a story outline and making it work well for you when you take it out to the world.
Yeah, I think it's a very valuable tool. I have a whole chapter on writing a marketable story outline in the way of storybook, but it does two things. Writing an outline is not only a good marketing tool, it also helps create your story structure. It's like a blueprint. And I think if you spend time writing and rewriting that outline, it'll, you know, you won't have so much grief in rewriting later. So I think that's all. I have forms and different forms of outlines I've used that my students and clients seem to use. And there are several examples in that chapter. So I think I'd refer one. The book is also on Kindle as well, if some of you are Kindle users.
Oh, okay. Good for you. That's lovely. Good. Okay, well, I think that we are almost at time. So I'm going to invite you then to, before I do the final wrap-up at the very end, invite you then, Catherine, to read out your piece that you'd like to read, and we shall all look forward
to
listening to that.
Julia, thank you so much for this. It was I really enjoyed doing the interview.
Well, likewise.
All right, I'd like to ask everyone to close their eyes and try and not only listen but feel the words. The way of story. In the beginning was story. The caveman rushed back to his tribe and excitedly acted out his encounter with some Paleolithic beast. This was his story, and forever after he would be remembered by this story. Stories have a sacred dimension not because of gods, but because a man or woman's sense of self and her world is created through them. These stories orient the life of a people through time, establishing the reality of their world. Thus, meaning and purpose are given to people's lives. Without story, we do not exist. The way of story is how we discover who we are. Thank you.
That's beautiful, and what a delightful note to end on. Thank you so much. I'm really honored that you joined us here today, Catherine, and I know that all of our listeners are taking such riches away, including myself, and very, very grateful for all that you've shared. So just to close then for today, I would encourage you to visit Catherine's website to buy the book and to read it and to apply the teachings to your own writing situation. And the two websites, again, just to refer you to are dailyom.com, which is dailyom.com, and, of course, wayofstory.com. So thanks again to you, Catherine, and thanks to all of you for joining us here on the call. I hope you've enjoyed what we've been discussing here today. And don't forget to join the fun and participate in our writers' community on Facebook. Connecting with other writers of a like mind is an important part of the writing journey. So we will look forward to catching up with you there, and also to catching up with you at the same time next month, when our featured guest speaker will be experienced literary agent and screenwriting professional, Julian Friedman, who will be speaking to us on how to become a successful screenwriter. So that dovetails quite nicely, I think, with what we've been discussing, some of the points we've been discussing today. So thanks again to you, Catherine. Thanks to all of you, and I wish you all a very good rest of day or evening, depending on where you are in the world.